You're listening to Face Off, episode 89, recorded October 4th, 2010. This episode of Face Off is brought to you by AgileTask. AgileTask is a task tracking application featuring an agile workflow, tagging for organization and achievements. AgileTask, your lightweight personal backlog tool. Check it out by going to agiletask.me. And RocketShipIt. RocketShipIt, the complete web-based multi-carrier shipping solution for small businesses and developers. Shipping rates, integrated tracking, and labels for UPS, FedEx, and USPS shippers. RocketShipIt is shipping made easy. Go to rocketshipit.it. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I am Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we talk about various aspects of web technology, things like web development, social media, and, web entrepreneurship. As always, you can get your the show notes for this episode by going to faceoffshow.com. So let's get into our sort of news and follow-ups. I had a cold. I have a cold. I cannot get rid of this cold.
How long have you had this cold? As long as our last podcast, right?
I don't think I had a cold last podcast, did I?
Yeah, I remember we were both sick.
I know you were sick.
Yeah, we were both sick.
I remember.
Because we recorded it on Monday, and I was sick like on Thursday, and you got sick on like Sunday.
Oh, yeah, yeah, because I came home Monday night. That's what it was. I came home. I left work early Monday because I was feeling like crud.
So this has been a week now, and you're still sick.
Yeah, I mean, like, I came off on, like, Friday feeling like it was done. And then now...
You taking your vitamin D, getting enough exercise and sleep, mister?
I haven't been getting enough sleep, to be honest with you. Mark and I have been playing StarCraft 2. I don't know if anybody out there plays it, but it gets late and stuff happens, so, you know... So I guess if
we get beat
or
something, and we're like, oh, we got to play again until we win.
Yeah, see, they either take, 5 minutes or an hour.
Yeah, it's really hard. And, like, when it's, like, almost midnight and you're like, well, all right, let's do one more. And then that last game takes, like, an hour and a half. You're like, oh,
yeah.
What happened?
Yeah. Good game, though. Kudos to that.
Good stuff.
Hey, so speaking of video games, this doesn't have anything with web technology, but I saw today that someone posted a live demo of Duke Nukem Forever, which is the sort of the unfinished game of all eternity. It's been going on for like 12 years, and some company finally picked it up, and it's like looking like it's going to get released. I mean, I guess a grain of salt or knock on wood, right? It's going to get released, but I mean, a playable demo is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. It's one of it doesn't seem like it was that long ago that somebody had bought the rights to keep going with that.
Yeah.
So it seems like if they've got something already, it's probably pretty promising.
Yeah, and that was like one of my first like big video games I really got into. I remember our buddy Jordan, him and another guy brought a computer over to Jordan's house, and they hooked it up with like parallel cables or a serial cable. I can't remember what one. And we're playing against each other. So it was like sort of the first networked multiplayer game that I ever saw played. And it was fun as heck.
Yeah, I remember getting Duke Nukem 3D, I think, Atomic or something. It was pretty cool.
All right, let's get into web technology. So let's get into our geek tool of the week. So our first geek tool I want to tell you about is really, really, really cool. I don't even have it here on my desk. This is silly. Is the Square credit card reader. You can get this by going to squareup.com. And this is really cool. It's a geek tool for me because I just got my reader. So for the longest time, you've had Square accounts, but you could never finish the final verification thing until you got the card reader. Because the whole point of this is that you can swipe credit cards. And so what you do is it's this little reader. It's a square. It's a little cube kind of, and it's got a slot in it. And so you plug it into the headphone jack of your Android or iPhone or iPad, I believe, are the ones that they support, maybe BlackBerry. And then what you can do is open up the Square app, and then you can actually swipe cards and put in a value, and it'll process like a credit card transaction. It'll ask you if you want to put a note on it. The person can even, they sign it on your phone. Like, it gives you a little landscape signature field, and they kind of take their finger and squiggle their name or whatever they want on it to sign it. And I think they have pretty fair credit card rates. It's for if you have the card present, like if you swipe it, it's 2.75% plus 15 cents for every transaction. And if you don't have the card present, like if you just key it in, it's 3.5% and 15%. So even if you don't have the card, you can key it in with the app. It does not require a merchant account or anything like that. It's kind of like PayPal. They just deposit it right into your bank account. I think the thing is the card reader is free. The app is free. There's no sign-up fees or anything. They just take their cut of your transactions. And that's it. You can get credit cards for anything. I mean, I got it just for like, you know, freelance work, or we always joke when we come to visit sometimes, like we'll buy each other dinner, you know, and we won't have cash to pay each other back. And I was like, well, you know, I'll take a 2.75% cut to finally get money back from old Mark Sanborn. You know, he's a dirty dog like that. He'll skip out of town before he pays you.
Considering the fact that the things are actually free, this is a really big win. I do deal in a bit of credit card transactions, and it is a fair price, especially for the fact that they give you the device. There's no setup fee or anything. They literally just send you it in the mail, and it works with, did you say Android or just the iPhone?
Android and iPhone, iPad, yeah.
The fact that it works with Android, iPhone, and iPad just makes this thing awesome. Yeah, man, it really is. This is really cool. I think this company is going to do really well just because a lot of people have those devices. The fact that, I mean, everybody has, well, not everybody, but a lot of people have credit cards. And, you know, like you said, having transactions between people and not having to go through, like, traditionally you have to go through some business makes this really cool. The only thing that I would be worried about is the security portion of it and how, like, if somebody... What if it's like maybe like a bad guy got this and just started stealing credit cards and swiping? It makes it the barrier for him a lot lower.
Well, the reader is just a reader. It's, you know, you have to have your phone. You have to log into your Square account with the application on your phone to swipe credit cards.
So it's tied to your. I mean, it's tied to something you can't.
Right, the reader by itself, it's just a little square with a little headphone plug sticking out of it. And you just plug it into the headphone jack of your device, and then it'll read the card and send it to the app.
So in order to I guess a phone is a pretty decent way to verify somebody's identity. And with the login, I guess that makes it pretty safe.
Right. There's like multiple levels. You could have a swipe code on your phone so that people can only get into it if they can swipe your key code. Plus, there's a username and password for the application itself. So I think it's pretty secure. The only problem was if I signed up for this a long time ago and they didn't actually have the readers. It took the readers forever because they were trying to get some Chinese – because basically a ton of people signed up for it. I mean a ton when you heard the free reader and like no setup fees or like maintenance fees or anything. It's just the fee for the transaction. A ton of people signed up and it took them forever to get the readers out. But I think finally have a manufacturer now, so I think it's okay.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. Hopefully they figured some way to mass produce these, and you know, if you sign up now, it doesn't take 6 weeks to get it.
Right, that's what I'm.
If that's the case, this is really cool. I want to sign up and get it right away. I remember when you first talked about this, I thought for some reason you had to pay $50 or more to get the reader, because usually, you know, like if you sign up to have a card reader in your store right now, it's hundreds of dollars to get a regular card reader with, you know, the keypad and everything.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree.
So, you know, like for doing web work and just, you know, even for paying some buddies at the end of a meal, you know, like when you go out or something, this is really cool.
Yeah, exactly. When you don't have cash. So check it out. Go to squareup.com and get one of your own. So let's get into it. I'm sorry. I'm sick, so I'm not like quite as woohoo as I normally am. Let's get into our web apps for this week. Our first web app is called DVUS. You can get to it by going to divvyus.com. This is one of those web apps that is super simple, and I love the simplicity of it. It solves one problem, and it does one problem well, and it does it with minimal hassle to the people who are using the app. So how many times you had a party and you're like having a dinner party or something, you're trying to plan things, and you're like, hey, guys, let's, you know, someone bring, you know, we need a couple of people to bring desserts and one person to bring, you know, a couple people to bring drinks, or, you know, or you get there and all of a sudden, like, four people brought desserts and there's no, like, food and you're trying to do a potluck, or, you know, or someone needs to bring balloons or anything. Well, what this lets you do is you can start a new DVUS and you know, you name it, like birthday party or Jade's birthday party or whatever, and then you just create tasks for it. And then what it does is it gives you a public link that you can send to your friends. Your friends can claim things, like claim tasks that need to be done for the party, you know, using this link. So I could go in and say, like, bring soda. Okay, Jade is bringing soda. And then it also gives you an admin link. So there's no login to required or anything. I mean, it just gives you an admin link. It's kind of like Doodle we were talking about in the past where there's no login. And that's almost what makes it so awesome is it solves this problem. There's no login. It's really simple, really cute and pretty. And it solves that problem.
When you first introduced this one to me as well, I thought it was just kind of a for parties and stuff. But really, you could use this for any task that you wanted to invite up. If you had, you know, some work to do and you wanted to say, all right, we got to get this stuff done. You know, here's a list of things. You go, guys, log in. The first come, first serve gets to pick.
Right. Absolutely.
First come, first serve. You know, it's a good way to get something done. And even if it is for like a party, this is really cool. And I like, you know, like how you said, there's no login. It's just go there and you get this URL. It's pseudo, you know, semi-private because you're not going to sit there and guess
security through obscurity, right? Yeah,
right. So yeah, really cool.
Yeah,
very simple.
Yeah, it's actually you're totally right. A party is not what all you can use it for. I mean, you can use it for anything. That is a bunch of tasks that people first come first serve want to come up and sign up for. So yeah, check it out. It's divvyus.com. I love these simple little web apps that just solve one problem. No login required or anything like that. They're great. Let's get into our next web app. Our next web app, I'm kind of on the fence on. I think we'll have a good discussion about it because I think it's called CodeBoffin, which is code BOFF.IN. And what it is a way to sort of give programming tests to potential candidates or something for a job. I guess it's kind of the use case they talk about. But it's just a way for you to give like a programmer a test to see their skills. And it's cool because you give them a task. They have to write code for it and whatever. It only supports two languages right now, C and C++, which kind of gets into what I really don't like about it. I don't like that it does a pass or fail on the programming test. That's kind of their use case is that you can filter out people that don't know how to program, you know, because if they fail the test, they can't apply for the job. But I don't even care about the pass fail. I think it's just a good idea to have these sort of generic tasks, a web app that candidates can come in, write code for that task, and then you can see their code, see their solution, and sort of see their look and feel of it. Right now, there's only C and C++, but they have all kinds of different little tests that people can take, and you can try for free if you wanted to see kind of what the tests are like and what the user interface is like. I think it's a good idea.
Do you know if it records their basically their session or their
that,
typing?
That
so you
is
can
a
see
great
how
question.
Their thought process goes? Because that would be, like you said, the pass or fail is kind of like, I don't know. It could be useful. I don't know. I looked at a few of the open tests, and I don't know. I could probably figure them out, but I could see a lot of people don't. Like the fail percentage for reversing words is 83%.
Right.
a list reversion is 67% fail, so I could see myself failing too. But I think, like you said, it's kind of important to see at least how they go about it. Are they sitting there for 10 minutes before they even type? Are they typing right away? Are they,
right.
You know, what are they doing?
Looks like it doesn't sort of record the whole session of them writing the code, which I agree. That's a really good point. I think that would be useful because, like, I'd want to see if someone just copied and pasted code or if someone actually was hacking on it there.
They do say they have anti-cheating measures, which probably helps prevent some of the copy and paste stuff. But yeah,
but
it would be nice to see.
I mean, they don't say what anti-cheat, you know, measures.
Right.
Which, I don't know.
And you don't get to use Vim. So, some people would be out of their elements here.
I'm looking at this. No, it doesn't give you a whole lot of it. I mean, I'd like to see more languages on here because I'm not a huge C or C++ guy, so I kind of wanted to be able to try one of the tests, but I wasn't about ready to start, you know, hacking around with C or C++ for the first time in my life right before, you know, the show for this web app.
Yeah.
But like Ruby would be cool to see, or JavaScript, PHP, you know, any of those that are big right now.
Maybe it's more for, like, if you can't pass this test, don't bother signing up for our job interview. Maybe it's more for screening.
That could be. They have things like you can assign private tests to specific people too. Like a candidate, you know, submits an app and you specifically send them a particular random test, or you can send them a link to a public test. You know, I just think this is a good idea. I think that when you're applying for a job, I think looking at like I've seen a lot of job applications lately that where they look at your GitHub repo because they want to see, you know, that's sort of a good feel for, you know, not only things that you fork that you're interested in, but also you can see things like projects that you've actually done yourself and look at code for those projects.
Right.
I think it's becoming more of an important thing to actually see code people are writing. This, again, still may not be the best thing. What's cool about this, it looks like, too, you can buy per test. Oh, actually, right now it's a beta, so all tests are free. But
it doesn't look like you can write your own tests either, which would be kind of nice.
Yeah, kind of. This kind of makes it a little more objective. I don't know, but I guess if you're the one hiring, you don't really want to be objective. Right? I don't know. I just thought it was kind of a cool concept, this idea of giving you a code test that you should try and play around with before you're even accepted for a job.
Yeah.
All right. Check it out at codeboff.in. Hey, if you guys have some news, a follow-up or web application or a geek tool that you think we should take a look at, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. You can tweet us out by going to twitter.com/faceoffshow. Email studio@faceoffshow.com. We want to hear back from you guys. Let us know what you want us to take a look at. We really appreciate it. So now, let's get into our topic this week. We've had a couple, like last week's topic I really enjoyed and this week's topic I really enjoyed because they're kind of like the sort of fundamentals of web development. There are just some particular things that maybe you use, but you don't really know kind of what it does or what it's about.
Yeah, it might be something you use every day. You probably do use it every day just to log into some of the sites you use. So today's topic is SSL, Secure Socket Layer. It's technically not called SSL anymore, and we'll find out a little bit about that in a minute.
Yeah, really?
So what is SSL? It is basically a means to encrypt a certain network segment, usually end-to-end. So me to you or me to google.com or me to gmail.com. It's actually now TLS,
I would think it was transport socket layer, but that's not right.
So like SSL was the first basic protocol that was started by Netscape in 1995, but it had some security problems right off the bat, and they went from like version 1 to 2, and then basically, it went to TLS right away, and that's what we're currently using.
Transport layer security.
But people still refer to it as SSL, so we will do so accordingly.
Yeah, I mean, I heard TLS. The only time I've heard TLS is dealing with SMTP with Gmail.
Yeah, that's actually the first time I ever heard it too. But it's basically been what we've been using as SSL for a long time.
Right. So where did this come from? I mean, how did this, as a standard or whatever, get started?
It started by Netscape, and I believe it was, you know, basically we needed some way to verify and encrypt sensitive information. Like, you know, this is the 95 when the internet, you know, the dot-com boom. We wanted to do banking online, and banking online we wouldn't be doing banking online if it wasn't for SSL right now. Right.
Well, so it's funny because it kind of has two jobs, right? It not only says, you know, this is actually PayPal.com, but then after it, you know, not only does it say this is actually PayPal.com, it encrypts the transactions between you and that website, right?
Yeah, maybe I should start off by saying the internet is a clear text type protocol. Like everything that is being sent to and from through HTTP is in the clear. So right. If anything you're typing into a form, whether it's your name, an address, or your password to someplace, if it's not over HTTPS, it's actually in the clear and someone can see that information.
Dun-dum.
So if you're typing your credit card into a form or something and you hit submit, if somebody was using a program, a packet capture program, they'd be able to see that information. And so that's really where SSL came in. They knew this, So they're like, well, we can't, you know, if we're going to do any banking information, we can't have the usernames and passwords going in the clear, or, you know, people are going to be able to log into these banks and do stuff.
Or even just the information that you get on your banking website, like your account numbers or anything like that.
Right. So there's two main kind of functions for an SSL, and it's important to know the two different areas, because in security, it's like authorization is not the same thing as authentication, mm-hmm. things like that. So SSL, one of the things it does is it provides identity to the person you're talking to. Usually it's signed by a third party. And so when you connect to that person, if you connect to them again, it's guaranteed that you're talking to that same person, as long as their private key hasn't been given out to somebody, which they, mm-hmm. you know, try to guard with their life. The other job for it is to provide encryption end to end. So all, from the beginning, once the identity is verified that you're talking to the right person and not, you know, somebody in the middle. Once the identity is verified, the next job it has is to provide encryption end to end. So right from the start, everything from then on, every parameter, every form that you fill in, it is all being encrypted with usually 128-bit encryption, which is so far unbreakable. They've estimated basically it would take the end of the time, all the time in the universe would not be able to crack it with the current computing power.
Not till we get quantum computing.
But, yeah, then all bets are off. But then again, then you just increase the bits. And
then we're screwed anyways. So, I mean, literally everything is encrypted, right? I mean, my packet, the address that I'm sending it to, is everything.
Yeah. So even so sometimes your URL has get variables.
Right.
Even those are encrypted. The only thing that may not be encrypted is the domain name itself, the DNS transaction, because DNS, like most people, don't use DNSSEC.
Right.
Which is so. So okay. You might be able to see the domain name, but everything else will be encrypted.
Cool.
So if you log into your bank, so there's two different kind of ways sites use this. Some sites just use it for when the person logs in, and other sites use it the whole time the user is logged in. Does that make sense? So some sites use it just when the person puts their username and password in the box and hits submit, right. And then after that, it's not encrypted.
Well, if anything then, inside is not like super sensitive, I mean, the only thing you want to make sure is you're not sending around the people's password in clear text. So that's kind of like your basic, you know, my username and password aren't being sent around in clear text, but really everything inside, you know, inside after I authenticate isn't really sensitive, so it's okay.
Right. And I mean, the reason they do that is because once you go into SSL land, things cannot be cached. It's right. More load on the server and things like that. So if it doesn't need to be secured, you typically don't want to secure it. One of the misconceptions is that it provides transaction between the buyer and or provides protection again for the transaction between the buyer and seller. So a lot of times you'll see like this site is verified with these guys and all this stuff, but it has nothing to do with the actual transaction. It's just if the identity of that person doesn't match the...
It's just the communication between your computer. It's not really anything else other than your browser talking to, or your computer talking to their computer. But anything else, you know, between or after that is not really an assurance.
Exactly. But I mean, some of the confusion I think comes from some of these SSL providers have like $250,000 guarantee. And like sometimes when people are at the site, they see this and they're like, oh, if I make a bad purchase here, they'll give me my money back up to this much, you know, and think they're safe and everything. But it actually doesn't do anything with the actual transaction. It's just the communication.
Right.
So I think we kind of covered why you would need one. I mean, if you're dealing with sensitive information, even if it's just like a username and password, if the user logs in and then they can do stuff that really matters, like book airline tickets or charge credit cards or do anything like that, you're gonna want to either encrypt just the username and password or everything, you know, especially
Mark, everybody has a different password for every website on the internet, so if someone gets my password for one site, it's not a terrible thing, right? It's just that one site.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, we all know everybody. So, I mean, there's also that factor too of that, you know, really a lot of times if you get one person's password, you really get their password to everything else.
Yeah, so it's, I mean, it's pretty important. Even if you have an API or something that has some API keys in the Git parameters, you're going to want to SSL that up.
Absolutely.
So what is involved with SSL? I mean, it's basically simple private public key cryptology.
Right.
If you want to really dive into that, you can check out the Security Now podcast. It's really interesting. And we'll explain in detail about cryptography.
But it's something
that computers can do. I mean, you can generate an SSL by yourself, self-signed, in a matter of seconds. Right. There's nothing to it.
So if you want to encrypt your communication, it's free to do, right?
It is at first glance. It's like, well, I can make SSLs all day long, and you can self-sign them. And if you're doing, local internet stuff, you can self-sign. The thing is the way the identity verification is done in the industry right now is through third parties like VeriSign. You've probably heard of GoDaddy's got a service. Thought.
So in every web browser, there is a list of trusted certificate authorities, right? And
yeah, root certificate.
They know VeriSign, they know GoDaddy, and it's kind of weird. I don't know how they get on the list or what. But you know, like Mark said, you can create your own self-signed certificate. But the problem is with like a lot of browsers, if you go to it, and the person or authority that issued that certificate is not in that browser's trusted list, then usually you get a big old warning.
Right. And if you are selling something or, have a site that matters, if you have big old, and the warnings, by the way, are getting more and more like they almost look like if I click this OK button, I'm going to bust out in flames or something.
Yeah, exactly.
They are like bright red, like huge all over the screen. They used to be just a little tiny pop up, but now they're pretty nasty looking.
Right. Or like some of them, like with Firefox, so let's say, I have an internal website that with a self-signed certificate. I get tired of that big pop-up getting, at me every time. Like with Firefox, you could say, add this certificate, add an exception. This certificate I know is trusted because I did it myself, or my system administrator did it. And so then you could go to that website with, no distraction. But like I know Chrome doesn't let you do that at all. That's a good question. I don't remember.
I think I'm sure you get over
one of there's like a couple browsers out there now that will not let you add an exception. So every time you go to that website, you have to click like yes, okay.
So a self-signed certificate, as far as the encryption portion of it, it is just as secure as any paid option there is.
Right.
Encryption is the same regardless. So what you are paying for is the verification of the person that holds the certificate. So how do they do this verification? usually for the cheapest SSLs, the least expensive ones, basically what they do is you sign up for it, you pay, usually a low dollar amount, usually $30 to in some sites $400, VeriSign's $500 for their cheapest SSL. They will email the email address.
That's all they do.
With basically a token, and you click it, and then you're verified.
Right.
So, I mean, it's basically an automated system that really is just verifying who purchased the domain name, and then you're verified.
Which is, I mean, simplest form is verification, right? Does jaderobbins.com, is the person buying this cert, the person that actually owns jaderobbins.com? They do the whois, they get my email address, they send it to me. I mean, it's verification in a way, right? I have control over the email address and that whois. I click the link. Okay, I'm verified. Jaderobbins is, from jaderobbins.com is buying this SSL.
So this is kind of a really strange industry because that email probably cost them fractions of a penny to send. And they're getting the cheap, the least expensive SSL, which we'll find out later is actually a free one. But there's a catch to it. So for the paid ones, it's about $30 for the the right. cheapest SSL you can get, and all they're doing is sending an email. It's kind of, I don't know, they may have a reputation at risk a little bit, but it's
kind of, they're probably paying for all the lobbying they did to all the various browsers to get them added as a trusted certificate provider.
Very good point.
So, that's kind of frustrating because, we can make these things ourselves on any Linux machine, or Unix machine. It's like you can make it. And really, if all they're doing is verifying, like that should not be that expensive, And then so the other problem then is really, it's really the most basic verification, Does the person who has this cert actually own that domain name? Yes. Okay. The most basic verification humanly possible. Is that really helpful? I don't know.
Yeah, and then the other thing is it's like, so there's two things, there's that the identity of the site, but then there's also the encryption. What if I'm, a small site and I want to provide my users with that encryption, but I can't afford to, pay for SSL. They're basically discouraging you from doing the encryption part because of the self-signing. You can't self-sign.
Right. It's basically two things. Like you want encryption and you don't want to be obtrusive to the user because users will get scared if they go to your website and they get a big pop-up from the browser saying like, whoa, this isn't verified. It's dangerous. And, is it dangerous? Kind of. I mean, for me, it's just, it should be cheaper because they should be encouraging you to encrypt things because things should be safer on the internet.
I could totally see a developer just saying, well, that pop-up scares too many of my users, so I'm just not going to do encryption, and I'm going to have a username and password field anyways, but it's not going to be encrypted.
Right, yeah, exactly.
And I think that's overall worse than the other scenario.
Right.
The self-signed scenario. So then there's this thing called extended verification, which is, I believe is fairly new in the last few years, I think, because it wasn't supported in IE7.
Right. Originally. So kind of what we were talking about, how, just emailing the whois is kind of like, it's kind of verification. Extended verification tries to take it like a step further, right?
Right. So the first time you've seen extended verification, you might not have known it, but it is the green bar basically turns the whole URL bar green. Right. And I don't know if they got together with all the browsers and said, hey, we'll give you like $20 million if you you guys put this green stuff here so we can sell expensive options.
Well, I'm not sure how it went down. I mean, what I've heard is extended verification actually is kind of a pain in the butt.
Well, it is, and we're going to talk about that. I mean, it is totally, it's not a whois automated email. They actually, in some cases, they will actually go to the physical place of business and confirm that you actually have a storefront. So the other thing they do is they'll check with your state to see if your business license is up to date and like going through the state, which is, these are actual, verification, physical verifications that somebody has to do. And that makes sense to pay for that.
Right.
I mean, someone's having to do this by hand. Also you need a legal opinion letter, from your company saying that you are the one that's responsible for getting this verification done. The one thing I had to note here was that there's a huge discrepancy in price. VeriSign's extended verification is almost $1,500 a year, and GoDaddy is $99 a year. So I think this is kind of indicative of how the industry is really, I don't know. I want to say I don't want to say they're ripping people off, but there's something going on here.
Well, again, the problem is it's sort of like it's this sort of loose affiliation of what is good enough. Like maybe VeriSign, like it may cost them $1,500 because maybe they really do go all out. I mean, maybe they do all that physical location verification. Maybe GoDaddy costs $99 for the extended verification because maybe they check the phone book or something. I mean, like how do you know, right? I went to Credit Karma, which is one of those websites we talked about where you get kind of nervous using, they actually have an extended verification cert by VeriSign Class 3 extended validation.
Oh, wow.
So that gives me a little bit more of assurance.
I guess one thing too that you get is you are able to get the VeriSign logo and display that on your site. And they had some studies Now, granted, this is from VeriSign, but they said they had some studies saying that if you had that logo, they had X percentage more conversion, on checkout than without the logo and things like that. They also said it was the most recognizable logo on the internet, apparently. So,
That's
I mean,
interesting.
I
I
think
wouldn't
you
think
are
that,
paying a
but
little bit for that badge, that seal of approval from VeriSign.
well, and like at the top, so like here in Chrome, it has the green bar or the lock, and it tells you the name of the company that it was verified with. So this says Credit Karma Inc. US. That's nice that it matches. Credit Karma Inc. matches creditkarma.com. I feel good about that. It's not just a lock. It is. It's just a little bit more of a visual indicator. What I don't like is I don't know if what is the what are the requirements to be a verifier, an extended verification agent. I don't know. No offense. I just don't. I don't trust GoDaddy. I don't think that they're doing the same stuff that VeriSign is doing. But at the same time, yeah, I'd rather pay $99 for my extended verification cert
Well,
than
yeah. I mean,
$1,400.
to the consumer, they're seeing the same green bar, and
Right,
they
exactly.
probably are not clicking on the padlock to see who issued the certificate.
Yeah.
So I did some checking. I checked out Google to, kind of see what they're using. They're not using VeriSign, but they're also not using GoDaddy. They're using kind of the middle of the road. Well, I don't even know. I wouldn't even say they're middle of the road. I'd say they're second best, or at least up there, which is Thought. Which is considerably cheaper than VeriSign.
Yeah, I mean, like the Gmail one is an extended verify. It's just a regular SSL.
I don't know. I think it's interesting that there's like this elite group of people that have the ability to issue certificates, and then that the prices are so
Right.
different. It's
Yeah, I
just
mean, I wish that just your basic cert with its basic verification, an email to the thing. I wish that was just super dirt cheap, because it really should be. Because it should just be encouraged. You should encourage people to try and protect sensitive information. And having a price does make, it shouldn't be free. A price adds sort of a barrier to entry to new people, like
Another
particularly
theory
spammers.
on that is that it's just enough money that, a spammer can't buy, a mass amount of SSL, HTTPS
Right.
domains. So
That's
there's that
okay, but
too.
then again, I think consumers need to be, fully educated on it, because, again, the problem is they see a lock and they think they're safe without really understanding what that means, right? The lock, like my mom or someone, she just sees the lock and she assumes that she's safer. The lock means safe. Don't put your credit card information unless you see the lock. The lock, that's sure, that encrypts your connection between them from other things, but it does not mean you're protected, right? Like you said, they could be taking your credit card information, storing it on a text file in the root of the web server, and you still got that little lock there. It looks great. Even if you go to that text file on the web server, you'll get that lock, but that doesn't mean it's safe.
So how do you install one? It's usually the process, it's pretty easy. You buy one, a lot of hosts have like a panel where you just copy and paste your key in there. If you're doing it yourself, you probably already know how to do it in Linux. You do need a dedicated IP address because it has to be tied to a server,
Right.
for identity reasons. So somebody can't have like another computer that it's going to.
Right.
There's different types of SSLs. You can get a wildcard, which allows you to do like any subdomain, .yourdomain.com, which are typically more expensive. There's
Yeah.
subdomain, which a lot of I see a lot of like secure dot, google.com or something like that. And then there's the full domain, which like Google, Twitter I think is got that. So can you get a free one? I think, because I mean, can you get a free one that's not self-signed? Yes. For open source projects, GoDaddy has a free SSL that you can get. You just sign up, give them your domain name, your domain for your open source project, and they will issue a free 1 year, 128-bit SSL certificate for you. There's also a company called the URL startssl.com, and they will give you a free certificate for a year for commercial reasons even, or commercial, like projects even. The only catch with them is it doesn't work in Opera. It works in everything else. Firefox 3 and above, Internet Explorer 7, or I think all the Internet Explorers, because it actually went into a Windows update, and Chrome. So it pretty much covers everything except Opera, which is most.
Yeah.
But still, like, if you're running a business, you probably don't want to use this. But if you're just, if you're that use case that we kind of talked about, you've got a project and it's not open source and it's just a little thing that you want to offer SSL, you could use this. Their website's kind of not the best looking website in the world.
Yeah, it's kind of funky. You know, what's funny though is in there supported by browsers, there's an Opera logo.
Maybe they've added that then.
I don't know. This sort of shows the flaws and the goofiness of it, right? Everybody but Opera. So there's clearly no standard. Different browsers can have different sort of rules. Like, I don't trust you guys, and it's like, it's kind of funky. You know what I mean?
It does have an Opera logo. Yeah, I thought when I looked into this, it didn't, but. Maybe it's changed. Maybe it's a newer version of Opera or whatever. But yeah, I mean, that's an option right there for somebody that really is not doing e-commerce. They just want to protect their user's username and password.
Right. So that's interesting. It's weird. It almost seems kind of like a weird sort of like racket, you know? There's different prices for it, but to the consumer, you get the same thing, you know? So... I don't know. Either way, make sure if you can, if you're sending out sensitive information, you use an SSL to secure it.
Yep.
So that wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. We would like to remind you that if you haven't subscribed to the show yet, you can go to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. You can subscribe there using RSS, Google Reader, email, however you want. You can also leave feedback for the show by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. Or just go to faceoffshow.com, find this episode, and comment in it. Tweet us out, twitter.com/faceoffshow. Studio@faceoffshow.com. Let us know. Love to hear from you guys. Thank you for listening. We really sincerely mean that. We appreciate it. Thank you for listening, guys. We will see you next week.